I'm going to read to you rather a long passage tonight, but it contains the essence of what I want to say. From the 9th of Luke, beginning at the 18th verse. Now it happened that as he was praying alone, the disciples were with him. Strange saying, isn't it? Praying alone, and his disciples were with him. Together they were together, outwardly. But inwardly they were far apart. Two worlds separated them. One was the world of self-surrender, and the other was the world of self-saving. Together, but how far apart. And he asked them, "Who do the people say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others that one of the old prophets has risen." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." But he charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised." And he said to all, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whosoever would save his life will lose it, and whosoever loses his life for my sake will save it." Now about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and James and John, and went up onto the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his countenance was altered, and his raiment became dazzling white. And behold, two men talked with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but kept awake. And they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. As the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is well that we're here. Let us make three booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. As he said this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my Son, my chosen. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silence and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. On the next day they had come down from the mountain. A great crowd followed him. And behold, a man came from the crowd and cried, "Teacher, I beg you to look on my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him till he foams and shatters him and will hardly leave him. "And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Jesus answered, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon tore him and convulsed him. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. And all were astonished at the majesty of God. But while they were all marveling at everything he did, he said to his disciples, "Let these words sink into your ears. For the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men." But they did not understand this saying, and it was concealed from them, and that they should not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. And an argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest. But Jesus perceived the thought of their hearts. He took a child and put him by his side and said to them, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. And he who is least among you all is the one who is great." John answered, "Master, we saw a man casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow with us." But Jesus said to him, "Do not forbid him, for he that is not against you is for you." When the days drew near for him to be received up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of him, who went and entered the village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. But the people would not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to bid fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them, and they went on to another village. As they were going along the road, a man said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, Foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath nowhere to lay his head. To another he said, Follow me. And he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But he said to him, Leave the dead to bury their own dead, but as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God. Another said, I will follow you, Lord, but let me say farewell. First say farewell to those at my house. Jesus said to him, No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. I've read this lengthy passage, but I want to put my finger upon one portion of it as the text around which I shall speak. They understood not the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. The background of this chapter is, of course, in the opening verses, the setting. Jesus went down to Caesarea Philippi, where there was a grotto, a white grotto, where the image of Caesar was worshipped as God. In that setting where Caesar was worshipped as God, Jesus turned to them and said, Who do you think I am? Now, he had not forced their minds on this question. They followed him on the basis that he was a good man, perhaps the best of men, but a man, a prophet. And they watched him for 3 years, night and day. And then he turned to them in the midst of it and said, Who do you think I am? Now he waited until this prayer hour. There was a prayer hour going on. And prayer is the most abject thing that a person can do. A person says, I'm not sufficient in myself. I kneel to another. I ask a boon, a light, a way. In the most humiliating moment, shall I call it, if you think of man as the center of the universe, the most humiliating moment when he was in prayer, Jesus turned and said, Who do you think I am? Now, suppose he had asked them when the winds and the sea calmed down before his voice, or he had raised Lazarus from the dead, or he had performed a miracle here and there, he would have coerced their minds. That moment would have forced them into saying, Well, you're certainly not a man to do a thing like this. But he was very much a man when he prayed. And yet he turned to them in the moment of prayer and said, Who do you think I am? And upon the lips of Peter trembled the great confession, the greatest moment perhaps in human history, when it dawned upon the people to whom he came that this was not a man who'd come through into life ordinarily, and an ordinary man's touch upon life. They saw through the veil of flesh the outcroppings of the divine, and they saw that this was the Son of God. When that dawned upon their minds, one would have thought that the whole of the rest of their lives would be fitted into that fact. And everything would become rhythmical and harmonious because they'd come to the supreme knowledge that he was the Son of God. Not man become God, but God become man. You would have thought that everything would have gone right from that moment on. Up to that moment, they were having a lot of trouble for themselves and others. And they were spotty in their following of Jesus. But now we would have thought that everything would have fitted in and everything would have gone on gloriously. The fact of the matter is that nothing was done right in the rest of the chapter. Every single thing that they did was a blunder. And why? Seeing that he was the Son of God, you'd have thought their spiritual lives would have now fitted into that fact and would have been adjusted and harmonious and real. On the contrary, they made blunder after blunder. And we'll put our finger in a moment upon the reason. And Jesus tried to get them to see, in the light of what he was saying, the reason. The moment he told that he revealed himself as the Son of God and they had caught it, he began to put the content into his being the Son of God. He said that the Son of Man is to be delivered in the hands of men, and the third day he rise again from the dead. He began to say that in the center of my being, the Son of God, is a cross. But immediately he began to talk about the cross. As soon as they found out who he was, he wanted to put the content of the cross. The account says, but he charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. In other words, at the center of my being the Son of God is a self-giving at a cross. Now they thought that at the center of his being the Son of God would be a self-assertion upon a throne. That's why Peter and James and John came to him and said, Lord, give us seats, one on your right hand and one on your left, in your kingdom. For they thought he was going to Jerusalem to set up his kingdom. It was going to be a self-asserting Christ now. He'd been humble up to this moment. But from now on, he'd assert himself and conquer his enemies and stand on top of things. On the contrary, he tells them, at the center of my being the Son of God is a self-giving. And then it began to dawn on them what he meant by that, because he turns in the next verse and says, and he said to all, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. At the center of my being the Son of God is a cross, and at the center of your being followers of mine will be a cross. You've got to lose your life too. You'll be crucified followers of a crucified Lord. And he said, he that saveth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life shall find it. And then he goes on, the account goes on, and we see the account of the transfiguration. This was a stunning blow to them to know that the whole thing was going to end on a cross, and that they were to follow him as crucified followers of a crucified Lord. And then he began to give them some reassurance that there was the dark side of here, but it was the glory side also. So he went up into a mountain. And in the act of prayer, his garments became luminous. His whole appearance became unearthly white. And there appeared with him Moses and Elias. Moses representing the law and Elijah the prophet, prophets. They were talking to him. And what were they talking about? This. His departure that he was to accomplish at Jerusalem. In other words, his death. They called it departure. But heaven was interested in that point. That point of the divine self-giving. So emissaries came from heaven, Moses and Elias, and talked with him about that departure, for that was the focal point of the whole business. In other words, heaven was interested, for that was the greatest point of it, the whole of his life. Peter, seeing Moses and seeing Elijah, and Moses representing the law and Elijah the prophet, and Jesus the new, said, let's make three tabernacles or three booths, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elias. Symbolically wanting to put them on the same level. Moses representing the law and Elijah the prophet and Jesus the new order. He said, let's put them together. Hold all three. The Jewish heart of Peter wanted to hold all three. As he spoke, the account says, a cloud overshadowed them. That was a cloud that cleared their thinking. Sometimes a cloud has to come over us to clear our thinking. And that cloud cleared their thinking and their attitudes. And they feared as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my son, hear him. Moses was fulfilled in him. And Elijah was fulfilled in him. You can't put them on the same level now. He stands out. Hear him. And they lifted up their eyes and saw no man save Jesus only. He occupied their horizon. He charged them not to tell this. On the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met him. You remember the man out of the crowd ran to him and said, teacher, I brought my son to your disciples. An unclean spirit has got hold of him, and I brought him to your disciples to cast out this unclean spirit, but they couldn't. Please help me. And Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long am I to be with you and to bear with you? Bring your son here. While he was coming, the demon tore him and convulsed him, but Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father. The account says they were all astonished at the majesty of God. Anybody who could, with a word, cast out a devil. They said, this is the majesty of God, the power over demons, the power over nature, the power over sickness, the power over death. That's the majesty of God. But while they were all marveling at everything he did, he said to his disciples, let these words sink into your ears. Get this if you miss everything else. For the Son of Man is to be delivered in the hands of men. I'm going to a cross. And they did not understand this saying. And they were afraid to ask him about this saying. They couldn't grasp the idea that he was going to a cross to lay down his life. They thought he would assert it into power. And here he was surrendering it into redemption. And they were afraid to ask him. Now from that moment on, there's a series of mistakes and blunders. Everything they did was wrong. What was the center of their difficulty? The center of their difficulty was this, that Jesus was in one realm of self-surrender, and the disciples were in another realm, the realm of self-assertion. They had not passed from self-assertion to self-surrender. They were still thinking in terms of what we're going to get. Peter said, Lord, we have left everything, then what shall we get? They'd left everything to follow Jesus, except themselves. They'd left fishing boats and nets and their parents and settled occupation, home, everything to follow him, except themselves. Now, the fact of the matter is that here they reveal the center of all our spiritual and moral problems. We're ready to give up everything to follow Jesus except ourselves. I've seen many a missionary give up home and loved ones and friends and business and occupation and prospects to become a missionary. Everything except the missionary. You touch him and he's still touchy. The self itself is unsurrendered. I've seen many a minister go into the ministry and give up everything to be a minister. Prospects of riches, this, that, and the other, they've surrendered to go into the ministry. They've given up everything except the minister. The self is still there, watchful of its position, place, and power. And the laymen are, I suppose, are saying to themselves, good, I hope the ministers and the missionaries will remember what the speaker has said. Well, I've seen many a layman come into the Christian movement and give up everything to be a Christian, except the layman. You don't give him sufficient position and place and power and see what happens. You go back in his tent and sulk. What is the central problem of our Christian life? Jesus put his finger on it. If any man would come after me, let him hate father and mother and brothers and sisters and houses and lands, yea, and his own self also. Why did they put that last? Yea, and his own self also. Why did that come last?
It's the hardest thing to
give up. Because that's the last thing we ever give up. We're ready for the father and mother and brothers and sisters and houses and lands to go, but the self is unsurrendered. Muhammad Ali, a Muhammadan patriot in India, in the enthusiasm of a speech during the non-cooperation days, said, for the sake of my country, I'm willing to sacrifice my old mother. And he said, yes, and I'm willing to sacrifice my children. And then he paused and he said, and yes, if need be, I'm willing to sacrifice myself. But he was last. He's ready to see the old mother and the children go first. But the self was still there. Now, the center of our spiritual lives, the center of our spiritual difficulties is a lack of self-surrender. All other things are marginal. Now, to clarify that, let me get that straight with you, if I may. A great many people think that Christianity means world surrender. That you've got to turn your back on the world if you're going to be a Christian. Out on the West Coast, I met Dorothy Ferrier. She'd been the head of charm schools, 65 charm schools across this country. She got $5,000 royalty on each one of those charm schools, added up. She had two big swimming pools on the West Coast. Your wealth is measured but for the size and number of your swimming pools. And she had a radio hour with 10 million listeners on charm, for everybody wants to be charming. She had a contract in her hand for $2 million for charm schools among the colored people. In the midst of this, she found a dissatisfaction. She didn't know what was the matter with her. She's on top of the world, and yet a world of tumult was going on within her. She thought maybe if she studied history, it might help her. So she got a book on what she thought was the history of the Pilgrims of New England. It was entitled Pilgrim's Progress. she began to read it in her bathroom and was converted. Then and there, really converted. Then she had this Roman Catholic background that Christianity is where renunciation. You've got to reduce life to a complete physical emptiness. So she walked out of her charm schools, walked out of her home, walked out of everything. And when I saw her, she was living in a trailer with her two children, and she looked like a witch. She'd reduced herself to ugliness from the Lady of Charm to this awful renunciation that the world I was had nothing to do with it. I saw her at that period. I said, you know what you're doing? You're running away from the world. You think Christianity demands world surrender. It doesn't. It demands something much deeper than world surrender. It demands self-surrender. And the moment you give yourself to him, he turns to us and says, now all things belong to you. The world, life, death, the present and the future, it all belongs to you, since you belong to Christ. Christianity demands more than world surrender. It demands self-surrender. And when you surrender yourself, then the world comes back to you. It's yours. You can walk into it emancipated, but it's all yours. All its beauty, its art, its culture, its loveliness, its relationships, it's all yours. Oh, she said, I see what I've been doing. I've been reducing life to that of the vegetable. And she was reducing it to that of a vegetable and calling it victory. Then there are others that believe that you have to, if you become a Christian, it's life surrender. You have to deny this thing called life and suppress it until you become a lifeless kind of a vegetarian, a vegetable person. A woman was a vegetarian in India, a missionary. And an Indian came up to the compartment when the train was at a station, his face all beaming. He said, oh, madam, I hear that you are a vegetable. A lot of us are vegetables, dead beef. But Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. Reduce life? No. He raises life to the nth degree until you tingle with life at every pore. Then what does it demand? It demands something deeper than surrender of the world and deeper than the surrender of life. It demands the surrender of yourself. The one thing you own. He asks you to pass it back to him and say you created it. Now take it back. The one thing you give to me, I give it back to you. It's yours. Do with it what you will. He cleanses it from 1,000 contradictions and its egoism and hands it back to us and says, now it's yours. Never was until you handed it over to me. Now it is yours. You're free. You've lost your life, found it.